We used to assume that animal brains were fundamentally different than human brains. But now times are changing, and the question isn't, do animals think, but how and what do animals think? Our guest this hour has been researching the latest in animal cognition and emotion, and she's with us this hour to share what she's learned. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Virginia Morell joins us today. She's a contributor to National Geographic, Science, and Smithsonian, and her latest book is called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. Do you think we need to rethink our relationship with animals if they have a richer cognitive and emotional life than we used to assume? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Virginia Morell, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, how would you say that the landscape has changed as far as what we think we know about the way animals think and feel?
It's changed very much over the last, well, starting sort of in the 1980s and up to the present day. There became a more sort of an evolutionary approach to looking at animal minds and realizing that many of our own talents probably didn't just emerge out of nothing, that they have a biological history to them. And so by looking at similar things that animals can do, we can trace those developments.
And are scientists, you know, allowed, I guess, to speak freely about what they think, what they suspect about these things now? Because it used to be sort of taboo to, you know, ascribe human behavior to, say, a chimp.
Yes, it was always the chimpanzee behaved as if it were doing something or as if it were thinking something or as if it were deceiving or loving. It was always the animal seemed as if it was doing something. And today, scientists are much freer to say, well, the chimpanzee actually deceived that other chimpanzee, or an elephant feels grief, or an elephant feels love. These things are not the emotions and the thoughts that we have about certain events aren't only experienced by humans. Animals also experience the world, and they act in the world. And yes, it's been a big change. And you see, still, some scientists are hesitant. You know, they all in science, it's always a matter of asking questions, of not saying anything too absolutely, because you want to question just what you just said. So there is some hesitancy. But when you're just with them and watching animals, oftentimes they will they just talk as if. There I am doing it myself. They talk as if the animal is actually doing what it's doing. So, for instance, I met a researcher in the Serengeti who we were watching this cheetah who was just crying its heart out. And she said, well, he's crying because he's lost his buddy who he needs in order to defend his territory. And without that partner, he is going to probably die. He will either be killed by another male cheetah or he'll get manged because he won't be eating well. But she said, basically, really, he is dying of a broken heart. He will die of a broken heart. And It was so striking to me to hear a scientist actually just say that, or to another researcher, Joyce Poole, who I joined in Amboseli National Park in Kenya, watching elephants. She talked about how elephants feel friendship, and the elephants had come to greet her because she hadn't been there for a long time, and they missed her, and they knew her scent, they knew her car. And one of them actually reached in the car and ran his trunk up and down her arm, and she just laughed. She said, yes, yes, it truly is me, you know, and I know I've been gone a long time.
And
so,
yet,
you see these people, you know, recognizing this is my old friend, or the elephant feeling the same way.
And you do tell the story, though, about Jane Goodall. You spent some time with her watching chimpanzees. And even she seemed sort of still reluctant to talk about behavior, to publish her findings on what you saw with your own eyes and thought, well, yeah, that's pretty human behavior.
Yes, it was a case of one young chimpanzee deceiving an older one who was her benefactor. She was an orphan, and he was taking care of her. But when he got a whole armload of bananas, he simply wasn't going to share a single one with her, and he ate them all. And her little eyes were watching him, you know, hungrily as each banana went down his gullet. And so she then happened to glance up, and there was Jane standing at this feeding station, and Jane showed her that she had one banana left, and she put it outside. And out of the line of sight of the male who'd fallen asleep. And little Dilly, the small chimpanzee, didn't make a sound. And she just tiptoed over there, got the banana, downed it in three bites, came back making little soft cooing, grooming sounds to keep Beethoven, the big male, asleep. And it was so clear to me, you know, it was that, like, when Jane showed that banana to Dilly, it was as if, you know, that they had communicated a thought to each other, just as we would when we kind of give wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, there's something secret we're going to we're planning this. And so it was a surprise to me when Jane said no, she couldn't say that Dilly actually deceived Beethoven. She would have to say Dilly behaved as if she were deceiving, or if Dilly were a human, we could say she had deceived Beethoven. That was in the mid-1980s when I was there at Gombe with Jane Goodall, and she said at that time, she said, the field is going to change, it's going to happen, but right now we're stuck in this position of having to be very, very cautious and always sort of putting it into an indirect way of saying what animals can do rather than to actually come out and say that they have minds that experience the world. And that is what's changed, is that scientists have found a number of ways to actually look inside other animals' minds and to do this in very, very clever experiments, so that one woman showed that horses actually picture another horse when they hear another horse neighing or whinnying. If they know that horse, then they have a picture in their mind of that particular horse. They don't expect to see another one. We know now that rats dream about where they were in the maze that they were trying to solve the day before. Songbirds, just like when we're learning new things, songbirds too kind of practice their songs in their sleep. You can see the same patterns in their brains at night. So there are a lot of things that are going on in animal minds that are not unlike what is going on in our own.
Yeah, so you're painting this picture of animals everywhere from songbirds, you think of having pretty small brains, to chimpanzees, who I guess we think of as having a more human-like brain, that it doesn't really matter the size of the brain. They do seem to have these cognitive worlds that look kind of a lot like ours.
Yes, that was one of the really interesting things to me, too, was that even when you go far away from our particular lineage, you see that animals are doing many of the same things. I think one of the biggest examples that I have of that, one of the best examples I have of that, is going to see the fish researcher Stefan Schuster in Germany. And he told me right up front, he said, you know, I've never accepted the idea that you have to have a large brain in order to develop intelligence. If what you do in your life requires you to be intelligent, then it's going to develop, it's going to evolve, if you need that kind of intelligent circuitry. So he was working with a kind of fish called the archer fish, which shoot blasts of water at their prey, insect prey, say, sitting on a leaf or a twig over the water, and they have to target that insect and watch it fall and know where it's going to land and get it, and they have to know exactly how hard to hit that insect because they vary the amount of water that they're blasting at it. And so all of these things are calculations that the fish must make, and they do them in the blink of an eye. And so he's taken that all apart and shown exactly what they're doing and how they target their prey and how hard they hit it and how they can calculate where it's going to fall so they can race to it and get it before another fish does. So he said the interesting thing to him is that everyone thinks that fish are just wet vegetables, you know, that they're like a cabbage or a carrot with fins. But he said then people come to his lab and they see the archer fish. And one of the things archer fish do in the lab, because they're so bored, is that they shoot the researchers and any visiting people in the eye. It's like a dark target, and they see that, or they might see your nostrils. And so I had that experience where I'm looking at the fish, they're looking at me, and suddenly, wham, these water bullets start hitting me. And I asked Stefan, I said, are these really, do they really think my eyes and my nose and earrings are these insects? And he said, no, they can tell the difference. And they never react like they expect the prey or eye to fall into the water. But he said, you know, what happens is that when people come here and they have that experience, before they might have said, oh, yeah, fish are really stupid. But he said after they get shot in the eye, they say, well, these fish are intelligent.
So the archerfish are kind of just having a bit of fun, a little target practice.
Just a little target practice. It's very boring. They're waiting around. They're sort of lined up looking at the researchers. It's like, come on, guys, let's do something. It's boring in here. And so if they see something to shoot at, they just shoot at it for the heck of it.
Well, and it's more than the target practice and them seeming to need some kind of stimulation.
Yes.
You also write about how they actually learn to have this incredible accuracy. I didn't know, for instance, that archerfish were hot on YouTube because it's fun to watch them knock stuff down.
Yes, it is. It is amazing to see them shoot, and they very, very rarely miss. I mean, in his lab, I think, you know, it's like almost a 100% score. Now, when they first have certain targets that are really hard, say a fast-moving target, it can take them a little bit as a young fish to learn, a little bit of time as a young fish to learn how to do that. So he was setting up an experiment, having these one, you know, the fish in a group, and they were supposed to shoot at these moving targets. But one fish always hogged the shots, and so he got so good he could hit anything, fast, slow, high, low, wherever it moved, he could do it. And the other fish just hung around. And so they thought, well, we'll get this guy out of the way because he's wrecking our experiment. And the other fish don't have a chance to shoot. Well, then they found that the other fish had actually learned how to make all those shots, the really, really hard shots, by having watched this first shooter. It would be like us watching Kobe Bryant do some fabulous layup shot. And then we just go out on the court, you know, after watching him five or six times, we go out on the court and do it ourselves. It was that kind of ability. So somehow they are able to picture in their mind what that fish has done in targeting the prey and then adapt it to their own situation to sort of put themselves in the picture and make the same shots.
So in terms of cognition, how impressive a feat is that, that they're able to watch another fish learn and nail the shot?
Well, there's a huge debate over who can do what's called social learning, and that's watching someone else of your species, of your kind, do something. And it used to be thought, well, it was only something that happened in animals that live in social groups. And certainly the fish are, in a sense, in the social group because they, you know, hang out together. But you still don't imagine that that's the same thing as, say, a chimpanzee sitting around with a group of other chimpanzees and learning how to do things socially, where there's a lot of interactions that we're very, very aware of because they look like many of the things that we do. Fish, it's much more difficult to judge what's going on with them because their faces are immobile. And then that leads us to think that they don't have any thoughts or they don't have any emotions because their faces are inexpressive. But that obviously is not the case because they do have this ability to watch each other and to learn. And that kind of copying or imitation is supposed to be one of the most difficult things to do because you have to develop this mental picture, kind of a mirror reverse of what the other individual is doing. But we know now from other researchers, there's a wonderful researcher in Austria who has a cold-blooded animal cognition lab, and she showed that turtles, too, who we think of as complete loners, that they, too, can learn socially by watching another turtle figure out how to solve a problem.
So
it's sometimes we make these definitions, and then as people test them or look at them, and they just simply look at animals where you'd expect to see something really brilliant, you see it, but then someone comes along and says, well, you know what, I'm going to look at it that in turtles, who we think of as not social at all, which is a good way to test social learning. And then you make a breakthrough because you discover, well, maybe it's not something that's so unique after all. Maybe it's widespread in the animal kingdom, and maybe it's a very, very useful tool to have. And the same thing happened with a researcher who was looking at the definition of teaching, which had been around for 20 years, and he decided to apply it to his ants. No one had been able to say even that chimpanzees could teach, but Nigel Franks in England showed that his rock ants do a kind of teaching when they have to learn. The scouts find a new home, and then they have to show a new path to the individual ants, one by one, take them to the new house, because these ants don't follow a scent trail. So the student ants have to memorize the whole route to the new house.
Oh, so even ants have a lot going on.
Even ants have a lot going on. You know, I mean, it's one of the most amazing things in my book, I think, is a story about how he showed that the ants do a form of teaching and outraged everyone. So, of course, the psychologists went running back and rewrote the definition of teaching to exclude the ants.
Well, we're talking about everyone from ants in the animal kingdom to fish. We're going to work our way up, talk about parrots and dolphins as well, as we talk with Virginia Morell, who's a contributor to National Geographic, Science, and Smithsonian. She is the author of the new book called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And we want to know what you think. Do we need to rethink our relationship with animals if they have these rich emotional lives, if they're learning and imitating and communicating with one another? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickard Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30, it's Chapter a Day. Susan Sweeney reads from Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. That's 12:30's Chapter a Day. This hour, we're talking with Virginia Morell, who has written a new book called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures, taking a look in the latest cutting-edge science about animal cognition and emotion. And we'll head to our first phone call now. We've got Liz joining us from Madison. Hi, Liz.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I am an animal communicator, so I approach this from another angle in that I talk to animals and they talk to me. I've talked to all sorts of animals, dogs, cats, horses, hedgehog. I've talked to an elephant. I've talked to a boa constrictor. So it's not just little family pets. And what I found in talking to animals over the years is that their emotional lives are so tied up with ours, and they are so rich and lots of times very fulfilled. And I think that we are discovering more and more just how much our lives are all tied up with animals, both in the wild and in our own homes, and we need to watch out for them, especially in the wild, so we don't hurt them environmentally and by doing the things that we're doing with our fossil fuels. And I just wanted to get your guests' opinion about animal communication and whether or not this is something that she's heard of or seen.
Well, first, let me ask you, Liz, what do you mean when you say you talk to these animals?
Well, I usually am asked by someone, say a pet owner of a dog, to talk to their animal about their illness, if they're close to death and they just don't know if they want to be euthanized or if they want to euthanize their pet, they're really torn. So I'm asked to talk to the animal to find out what they're thinking. And so I will have a conversation in which I can actually hear the animal's thoughts. It's done by mental telepathy. And I find out from the animal just how they're feeling, if they hurt, if they're ready to go, if they want to pass, and if they want their owners to help them pass. So, but there's all sorts of reasons that people ask me to talk to their animals, both behaviorally, emotionally, or just wanting to know what's going on with their pets.
Right. So that's something that sounds very cool to do, but maybe not something that's going to pass muster in a lab. But what do you think, Virginia Morell?
Well, I'm often asked this question about whether or not, you know, there is some kind of mental telepathy between animals and people. And certainly we read each other's behaviors, and especially an animal like a mammal that has a lot of expressions on its face. And its eyes are talking to us, transmitting, you know, messages of love or fear or hate or anger. So the ability to pick up on those is really a wonderful thing to have. But the researchers who I spent time with were not looking for mental telepathy, you know, trying to investigate that. They really want to understand how animals perceive and think about the world in a more concrete way. And so probably the best example of that is the researcher Irene Pepperberg, who had the wonderful parrot Alex, African gray parrot, who she worked with for over 30 years. And I was fortunate to be able to meet Alex and Irene I met them in 2005, or 2006 rather, and it was one of the most remarkable meetings that I've ever had, because Alex was such, not only could he talk, but he had a personality. And we know now that all animals have personalities. It's an area that's been thoroughly investigated, and you can say, yes, there are certainly shy animals and bold animals, and Alex was very bold and very much a parrot unto himself, I will say. So she had a way of talking, of asking him questions so that she could find out how he perceived the world, and did he have an understanding of numbers and an understanding of abstract concepts such as color and shape. She would hold up, say, a green cup and a green key to Alex's eye. She put them on a little tray and would say to him, "How same?" Alex would say, "Color." "How different?" "Shape." And he had this lovely, sweet little tinny kind of a voice, almost like a cartoon character, and his beak would open and the words would pop out, and it was almost like you could see them in a little bubble next to his mouth. It was so lovely to hear him. I've never forgotten Alex's voice. And then while she was working with two other parrots, he would sit in the back of the room, and he sat on his cage, and he was practicing his new words. And the two words he was working on the day I was there were brown and seven. And brown he practiced by holding up a little toy cube that was painted chocolate brown. And he would say, "Tell me what color." And everyone in the lab, the three researchers, would say, "Brown, Alex. The color is brown." And then he would try to say it, and then again, after a little bit, he would hold up the block. "What color?" "Brown, Alex. The color is brown." And this was how thousands and thousands of repetitions like this was how he learned how to say these words. And as he was doing it, I thought, that's so nuts. I can't believe, is he really practicing? So I just asked Irene, I said, "What is he doing?" She said, "He's practicing. That's his job." And actually, in the wild, we know now that songbirds and, we're not sure, I mean, we're still learning about parrots in the wild, but certainly songbirds in the wild, male songbirds will practice their songs. They have to rehearse, because when they go out there to sing and defend a territory and try to attract a mate, they have to be good. You know, it's Carnegie Hour time. You don't want to sound like you're doing it the first time in your life. So Alex was so certain of himself that at one point in the classes that were going on, one of the other parrots was very hesitant or having a hard time saying the word green, and so he's kind of shivering his feathers and making this little goo-goo-goo sound, and so Alex just spoke up, "Talk clearly, talk clearly." And told, you know, basically telling that parrot, you know, "You've got to do it right. You've got to do your job." And Irene sort of scolded him, and then he was felt very sad because he was scolded, and he asked her to take him down to the hallway where there was a beautiful tree that he could see through the window, and he loved that green light. And his way he asked her was, he said, "Wanna go tree?" Just that sweetest little voice. And so she walked him down the hall and into that green light.
Yeah, that part was kind of sad. He had to go look at a tree out a window.
I know.
The world's
smartest
parrot, yeah.
You know, that's part of being a captive parrot. He was born or hatched in captivity, and certainly he had spent his whole life in captivity. And the thing that people often don't realize about animals, especially something like an animal such as Alex, who is an older, mature adult parrot, was at that point in his life he would be very afraid of new things. And so even me coming into the lab, I had to really hang back and keep my distance from him and the other parrots, because I was new, and so even if you put him outside, it would be so terrifying for him, because everything would be new and disturbing.
Well, I want to take another phone call now. Let's go to Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tom and Stoddard, yes. Hello.
Oh, okay, hi. Sorry, I took the wrong Tom. Tom and Stoddard, welcome.
Okay. The thought I have is that chimpanzees and bonobos actually would be able to talk if they could hold their breath, we know that they were separated in Africa because they couldn't cross the river because they can't swim, and you have to hold your breath to be able to swim, and you also have to hold your breath to be able to talk, and they've been very knowledgeable about understanding things when humans are trying to get them to talk, but they just can't do it because of breathing.
They don't have the same anatomical structures as we have, which prevents them from being able to speak. But beyond that, there's another issue that differs between ourselves and not only chimpanzees and bonobos, but most other animals. But parrots, dolphins, elephants, bats, seals, all have an ability that enables them to do something called vocal learning. And that means that you hear a sound and then you can imitate it. And certain parrots, such as Alex, the great African gray parrot, and green parrotlets in Venezuela, humans, elephants, dolphins, we're all lifelong vocal learners. So that means we don't stop learning once we reach sexual maturity, such as songbirds that may imitate songs that they hear, but once they get their song, that's it. They don't learn new ones. We can go through life, and I can hear someone's name, such as your name, Veronica. You say it to me, I can immediately say it back because I have this vocal learning ability. Now, the chimpanzees don't have that, nor do bonobos. So it's not just a matter of holding their breath. It's a matter of how their neurons fire in their brains, and they don't have that ability.
But it is something that parrots can do, as you were saying. And
parrots can do it, yes.
And that makes them, you'd think that would make them exceptional animals to study.
It does make them exceptional animals to study. The problem is to study them in the wild and to find out, well, how do they use this? Because obviously they're not using their ability to imitate sounds in the wild. They're not imitating us. I mean, they're imitating something else. What are they imitating? And there's a researcher in, he's now at Berkeley, Carl Berg, but he's been working with green-rumped parrotlets in Venezuela, and they're a very small parrot. Normally parrots nest high in the trees, and so it's extremely difficult to find their nests. They nest in tree hollows. And then if they fly, you know, how are you going to follow them and see what they're doing and who they're calling to and how they're using it? But the green rump parrotlets, they nest in hollows in fence posts. And the scientists decided, well, if they would nest in the other kind of nesting boxes that we put out for them, we could study a whole group of these parrots. And they've done that, and they have 120 nesting boxes on this ranch in Venezuela where they can go and they can put microphones and cameras and video recorders, everything, inside the nests. And because the nesting boxes are so valuable, it is hard for a parrot to find a tree hollow. So these nesting boxes serve as that, and they will not give their nesting box up for anything, even if there's a camera inside recording everything they're doing. By studying them, Carl Berg is working out how the parrots communicate with each other and how they use their, why they imitate. And one of the things he's found is that they have what are called signature contact calls, and they use these very much as we do our names. Dolphins have something similar, which are called signature contact whistles, and we know that they send out these whistles. When they call someone else by their whistle, they are targeting a particular individual. And the same thing is true with the parrots that Carl studies. They are calling a particular individual when they make this tiny little sound. It just sounds like a soft peep to our ears. But when Carl played the whole recording for me, when he actually stretches it out so that you can hear everything that's in that call, it sounds something like, blah, 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 blah.
So there's a lot more there than a peep.
There's a lot more there. There is a lot more there. And part of that little peep sound to our ears is the call of, say, Bob or Henry or Tom or Mary. Maybe Bob is coming home and he's got a crop full of seeds and he's going to feed, and he wants to feed Mary, his partner, who's down in the nest. And so he's calling her, Mary, it's Bob, Mary, it's Bob, Mary, it's Bob. And she calls back. She will only come up when she hears it's her partner's call. She doesn't come up to any other guys, only his. And then they will get together, and he will feed her. But as Carl says, you know, when you can put something, when you can call someone by name, then you can also have an exchange of information or a conversation. So there's probably a lot more going on in that call than, "Hi, Mary, it's Bob, I'm home." There's a lot more than, "Hi, honey, I'm home," going on in that call. And he thinks that there are these conversations. It could be, "Hi, honey, I'm home and I want sex," or, "Hi, Bob, I'm glad you're home, but I want to eat before we go off and do it." So there's something else going on because of all of this extra information that accompanies the part, this very small part of the call that they know is the contact call.
To another Tom now. Let's go to Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Well, mine is a lot simpler than the lady who called in a few calls ago. I found, I guess through boredom, that birds especially respond back to calling to them. And basically what I do is I mimic their call, and then that piques their interest. And I live in kind of a woodsy area, so I've got that. And I've got some swamps nearby, too, so I've got quite a range of birds, from cranes all the way down to hummingbirds. And it's gotten now that, well, like right now it's the birds that have seed over the winter, and I've got like four feeders out, and I'll have different birds that will come to it, and I can sit near them, and there's one I can actually hold, and the birds will actually come to it as I hold it. And and then in the summer I've got hummingbird feeder, and they'll be like a foot from me, and yet cranes and geese and stuff, you know, I'll call to them, or I'll hear them calling, and I'll call back, and then I can hear a change in their voice, and they'll be more excited, and they'll fly, you know, right over the house. And last year in the fall, as they were leaving, and I think it was late October, I could hear something real faint up high in the air, and I looked up, and I could see about 10 of them flying in a real tight circle, way up, maybe 500 feet, for about 5 minutes calling, and I called and I called, and then they left for the season, and they were gone. But I think anybody can do it. You just listen to them, mimic them, and you'll see that they will, you know, they'll be interested in you, and whether I'm at work or home and stuff, and it's like they're little friends.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. And Virginia, what do you make of that?
Well, certainly birds, if they hear another call that sounds like one of their kind, the males in particular, if a person is imitating, say, their song that sounds as if you might be another male invading the guy's territory, he's going to come and check you out and find out what's going on. Now, the fact that he's putting out food for these birds, or like the hummingbirds are aware of him, birds have very, very good eyesight. They see more colors than we do. We have about 2.5, or not quite 3 color cones. They have 4, no question about it. It's not like 3.5. It is 4 color cones. So they see probably in greater detail and certainly in a greater color range than we do. So that when they are looking at something, they recognize things. And we know from studies at the University of Washington with John Marsliff that crows recognize individual human faces. And if you do something rotten, say go up to the crow's nest and take that crow's babies, the crows are never going to forget you. I've been out with him walking on the campus there when he wears the mask that he's worn when he's taken crows out of the nest. And the crows mob him. They come down. And then they teach their younger ones that this is the bad guy. This guy, out of all the humans who are walking around, that one's the one you got to watch out for. So the idea that animals are oblivious to their surroundings or are not paying attention to things is another change that we've seen as scientists pay closer attention to what animals are doing in the wild. I love this story that Joyce Poole tells about putting out an area where she was marking off areas for vegetation transect studies, and so she was putting out little strings around, say, a meter of grasses and a square meter of grasses. And she said, then the elephants came through, and it was like they almost jumped to one side. Whoa, you know, that string wasn't here yesterday. So we think that animals are somehow kind of stumbling along like zombies or just oblivious to everything that's happening in the world, that they're not experiencing it, that they're not paying attention, that they have no memory. You wonder how anyone, any animal, could survive if that was the case.
We are talking this hour with Virginia Morell. She is the author of the new book called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures, taking a look at new research in animal cognition and emotion. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this new research sort of fleshing out the inner lives of animals, both how they think and how they feel? Does it change the way that you think we should interact with animals in our world? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email address to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stay with us next hour as we talk with Faisal Abdullah, who is the UW-Madison's artist in residence. He'll be with us in studio. And also next hour, an interview recorded with the one-man orchestra known as Heatbox. He makes all of the music with his mouth. That's coming up next hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking with Virginia Morell. She has written a new book called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And Virginia, I want to talk a little bit about rats, because some of what you told me when we talked earlier blew me away. And that is that there seems to be audio proof now that rats actually laugh.
Yes, they do. This was a discovery that was made by Jaak Panksepp, who studies something that sounds very daunting, affective neuroscience, but basically it means our emotions. And he's at the University of Washington in Pullman now. But he had been working with rats for many, many years. He had always wanted to study happiness, but couldn't get money for that, so he studied depression instead. And then he had to have happy animals as a contrast, as sort of a control to the depressed ones. So he found one way that you could make very exceptionally happy rats was to have a group that just got to play together, and the depressed rats were held in a place so they couldn't play. And as he watched the rats play, he noticed that they often had their mouths open, and he wondered what kind of sound they were emitting, because he knew that rats oftentimes make calls that are so high-pitched that it's just beyond our hearing capabilities. They're out of our frequency range. And so he put a bat detector in with the rats and attached it to an audio device so he could hear what was going on. And lo and behold, they were making a little high-pitched little squeak in a breathy kind of way. And he made recordings of these, and they analyzed them through studies of this call's sonogram, which is like a sound picture, and showed that in a lot of ways those sounds mimic our the kind of sonogram we would have of our own laughter. And, of course, other people dispute this, but what do you do when you play? You oftentimes laugh. And so he really showed that the rats laugh, and that also they even have tickle skin, so that if you tickle a rat in a particular place on its belly where it likes to be touched, it will make the same sound.
Oh, my goodness. That's so hard to get your head around, that you could have a laughing rat, isn't it?
Well, it is, because, again, we don't expect to have rats. We don't, for some reason, you know, we can see anger in animals, but we don't want to allow them to have the positive emotions such as joy and laughter, happiness. But as he showed, that it's very logical that they would have these things because they provide such social benefits. And when a rat who hasn't been allowed to play, and you take a male like that, and a male who has had lots of social activity and a play pal all his life, and they grow up, and then you put them in a cage with a female who's going to choose some guy to be her mate. She doesn't want the guy who has no social experience and who's never laughed. She wants she wants the funny guy over here who knows how to control his emotions and how to inhibit perhaps his aggressiveness and knows how to be social. And how do you learn to be social? You learn it by playing, because you do all these sort of faux aggressive moves, and you learn sometimes you're the attacker, sometimes you're the submissive one. You role play.
So do you think that means that we should be extrapolating out and assuming that other animals laugh as well? Because why would only rats laugh, if that's indeed what this is?
Well, that's the question, is where else would you see it? And certainly chimpanzees have a form of laughter. And, you know, I mean, I can't do an imitation the way that Jane Goodall or someone can. But they certainly have their smile faces. Dogs, we know, have smile faces. Cats have a way of expressing to you that they like you. You know, elephants, I mean, my goodness, baby elephants, there's so many pictures on the internet of happy baby elephants and the smile faces that they have. So, yes, it's not something that is unique to people. Mm. And probably in many cases there is a vocalization, some kind of laughter that accompanies that particular feeling of being happy and joyful and playing with your pals.
Well, let's go to another call now. Tammy is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Wonderful program. I am a big advocate of animals having emotions, probably because I'm a pet owner. The question that I have is, can you talk about self-awareness in animals? And I'm kind of curious on how they test for that and what that kind of means in regards to their cognition. And I'll take my comments off air. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Tammy. Virginia?
Yes, self-awareness has been one of those big questions, and about do other animals really realize that they are an I, if you will? You know, do they know that they are separate from other animals? Do they have a sense of themselves? Can they picture themselves as individuals? And in many cases, it seems that they can. Now, there's one particular test that they do where they put a mark on an animal, say a chimpanzee, say a red dot on its forehead, on his or her forehead, and then let the chimpanzee look in the mirror, and the chimpanzee will pick at that mark. And so that's a sign, supposedly, that the chimpanzee is aware of who it is. And so that became the big test, and people have applied it and have tried to show that the same thing can happen in dolphins if you put a mark on them, that they will swim in circles in a very odd way to get a look at this mark on themselves. And elephants also do this. But there's, some people say, well, it's not just that you have to look in a mirror and see yourself, because dogs, when they look in a mirror and see that reflection, they often initially think it's another dog, which is actually chimpanzee who would initially think it's another chimpanzee until they get used to what the mirror properties are. So the dogs, though, eventually they seem to get bored, but they recognize their own urine scent. So is that the same thing? Does that qualify the same way? These are some of the debates that scientists have. I did go with a researcher to Baltimore Aquarium, where I saw a test that they were doing to see at what age do young dolphins actually begin to recognize themselves in the mirror. And they had a young male dolphin who was just a few months old. And as he went swimming around with his mother and aunts, they put this mirror up so that he could see him. Well, they could all see themselves. And he was just so funny. He suddenly stopped in front of it and then kind of stood, swimming sort of erect and looking into the mirror. And then, well, what do you do when you first see yourself in a mirror and you start to realize, oh, that's me and that's not another dolphin? You want to investigate all those places that you can never see before. So he started to open his mouth a little bit and then a little bit more, and finally, the whole gullet so he could see down his and he tipped his head over so he could look at his blowhole. It was just too funny for words.
Well, let's get an emailer in on this. We have Dania in Viroqua who emails, can you comment on the unusual interspecies kind of relationships we've been hearing about lately? A cheetah befriending or caring for a dog and a wild deer. Are these instinctual anomalies or the budding of some kind of animal evolution? I don't know. How do you frame that kind of relationship?
Well, oftentimes these relationships develop in captivity or some sort of an unusual situation where the animals are thrown together. Most of the time, although you do see unusual relationships, say between a cat and a parrot, or something that's really odd, But oftentimes, most often, these examples involve mammals. And mammals, we know, especially young mammals, they need to be held and protected and loved and cared. I mean, it's part of just being a mammal. And so that they reach out to some other mammal for this kind of physical contact shouldn't come, and an emotional contact shouldn't come as a surprise. It surprises us because we think of animals as sort of, again, always being angry, and if they have an opportunity, they just jump on the next guy and beat him up or eat him or something. But, you know, other animals do need to have affection and comfort and warmth, and where do they find it? And they need a friend. You know, it goes back just like with the rats that always wanted to play, and the little playful rats, they would be waiting for their opportunity to get together and play. It's part of being alive, I think. And I would, it's not unusual even to see this kind of behavior in birds, certain species.
So having heard all of this hour, and you know, I know you care deeply about animals. You write about your dog in your book and the games that she invents. What is sort of the end game of all of this research on animal cognition and animal emotions? Is it to find a way to treat them with more dignity and gentleness, or is it something more?
Well, there's probably two things. One, we would like to know, where did our abilities come from? Is language something that's unique? Are mathematical abilities unique? You know, we're always interested in what makes us special. And what a lot of this research shows is that perhaps we aren't as special as we would like to think, you know, that there are biological roots to our abilities. But beyond that, what interested me most is that we actually are getting in a chance to see that there are other minds around us. All of the animals around us have minds and are perceiving the world. And yet we live at a time in this sixth extinction and climate change when we are stressing so many species of animals and limiting their amount of habitat. We're heavily poaching the elephants. We're very close to losing many, many species. And when they go, their minds go with them. And when you think about, we right now, as far as we know, this is the only planet in the solar system with life, and these minds are all unique. And so it's not only should we value the animals just because, you know, they're wonderful to have on this planet, but they too have minds and thoughts and emotions. And it seems to me that we would want to place an extraordinary value on that. So I, you know, I'd like to see us add that idea into our conservation efforts, also into how we treat animals that we raise on farm situations or have to use in laboratory situations. We need to think of them as individuals who have true lives and are not simply robots somehow existing in a kind of strange blank way on the planet, but they actually have minds. And here we are in a whole new frontier that these scientists are opening up to us and looking into a land that was once forbidden. You were told, you know, and you could not investigate the mind of the animal. And these pioneer researchers who I write about are taking the first steps, helping us see how much we have yet to learn.
It sounds like you're talking about like a cognitive biodiversity that we need to be thinking about.
That's a very, very good way of putting it. And yes, I think it is a cognitive biodiversity that we should be thinking about. And hopefully we will appreciate the animals for having that and find some way as our population explodes and as we continue to move into every possible niche there is on the planet to allow other animals to have their lives.
Well, Virginia, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. It was very fun, and I enjoyed the calls, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Virginia Morell, our guest this hour. She is a contributor to National Geographic, Science, and Smithsonian. And we've been talking this hour about her latest book. It's called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And we are ending a little bit early with our guests this morning. Have some news. If you haven't caught it from last week, next Friday will be my last Friday with you during these mornings because I'm moving on to new horizons, new shows here at Wisconsin Public Radio. In fact, I'll be developing a new show with Rob Ferret, the guy who is answering your phone calls this morning. And you'll be hearing more about that in the days to come. And also taking over will be Anne Strainchamps, who is currently an interviewer on To the Best of Our Knowledge and the creator of the Wisconsin Life series. She'll be hanging out with you on Friday mornings from 9 to 11. So lots to look forward to there, lots of new topics and horizons to explore, and hope you'll stay with us in either case. And this hour, I want to thank Joe Hartke for his technical direction and Rob Ferret for answering your phone calls. If you want a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 322D. And if you want to check in some more, keep the conversation going, you can stop by our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'll see you back here next week.